Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in, Tom, for KER Politics. Got the show divided up into four segments as we normally have them divided up. We're going to talk about, obviously, what we feel are the four most important topics relating to America today. We're going to start out with the economy because the economy is a very, very important topic right now. Certainly important for Big Al. As you know, I live somewhat out of the mainstream. I'm about a 40-minute drive from the next major city, which happens to be Bellingham, Washington. I have cut down my travel because of the price of gasoline. It cost me $85 to fill my tank, and so I've cut my trips down into Bellingham to buy groceries or what have you to a minimum. It's gotten me extremely well organized, I will say that. But I am taking advantage of some of the nuances that are new to our society that I find to be in a very effective way to deal with some of the hardships that we're facing, i.e. the high cost of fuel. It's actually easier for me and much more cost effective to call a grocery store and have them deliver. The delivery fee continues to be $9.95. Regardless of how much you spend, I'm taking advantage of that, and it's working for me. Jimmy, one of my favorite numbers when we talk about the status of the economy is the employment numbers. I'm pretty skookum to the fact as to realizing that employment numbers are very, very easy to manipulate, and they are manipulated constantly. What do you have to say about the current employment numbers, which are down to about an unemployment number of 3%, which is unheard of?
Yeah, so the employment numbers are the unemployment numbers, the numbers that they just came out with new jobs today. That was 390,000 jobs in for the May report, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics. The market had estimated about 328,000 jobs, but 390,000, obviously, that's a pretty big jump, or you know, better than the expectations. However, we're still talking about retail jobs falling by 61,000 jobs, merchandise stores, apparels, and garden supply stores, and then of course, what one of the big increases has been in hospitality. People are going back to work, going on hotels, you know, taking a few more vacations, and of course, maybe trying to get out to dinner. That's still 7.9% below the 2020, February 2020 levels. Mm-hmm. So we haven't reached the numbers that we, you know, when we locked down our economy in 2020. So, you know, the administration's saying, you know, oh, wow, we're getting back and these employment numbers are going to be great. There's a lot of different information out there that needs to be considered when you're considering this numbers. And I'll tell you, you can see by the markets, it's not that great news, because, in fact, the markets are actually falling today across the board by, you know, sometimes S&P, I think, down by 2.5% at this time we're recording. And, of course, Dow's down by 1%. We'll see how that goes throughout the day. But basically, you're seeing some areas where you've got job growth. You're seeing some areas that are losing jobs. The biggest problem here is how many people walked out of the workforce because of COVID and haven't gone back in. So they're not looking for work, and those numbers aren't reflected. And we're showing over 11 million jobs that we still need to fill in America that are not being filled. These all have a very big impact overall on our economy.
Well, they really do. You know, I used to do a radio program with a real expert on unemployment. His name was John. I forgot John's last name, but I'm sure all of our regular listeners know who he is. He could take the employment numbers, put enough truth into them that people would understand that when things appeared, according to the press, to be looking good, they were actually looking very, very negative. You know, the real harbinger, for lack of better terms, or thermometer of business in the United States, business activity, et cetera, in the United States is the markets. And the markets continue to be absolutely abysmal. For my sake and for the sake of my buddies who are on our blog, I really hope that the markets turn around, because I know you guys are invested as I am, because being invested really is a smart place to be right now. You have to do something. You either have to have your money in cash, which I think is kind of silly, or you have to roll the dice and be in one of the markets. Jimmy, any comment?
Yeah, I think, you know, the other thing that we have to figure, because, you know, you can manipulate these numbers, you've got to figure that we are not seeing the full effect of inflation on economic growth and potential GDP issues. And I, as I've predicted and said, you know, the first quarter was a surprise, a decline in the GDP. It wasn't that much of a surprise to me, primarily because inflation was so high and our GDP growth didn't keep up with that. And you're very likely to see the same thing in this quarter, which would indicate a recession, two consecutive quarters of negative growth.
Right.
And of course, you know, with oil and gas prices, energy prices so high, you're going to see higher prices in every bit of transportation and every bit of manufacturing, and just the ability to go to work back and forth. These things are going to have a huge impact. And of course, the summer travel season is going to be affected by these high prices, which really affects everything in our economy. So I really do believe that the numbers, one day's report that showed a semi-positive role with more job growth than expected, is not going to save us from the problems, that the institutional problems we have, inflation right now, overspending by the federal government, and of course the policies that are restrictive, regulatory policies that are slowing U.S. domestic energy production and forcing imports while we're in the middle of a crisis around the world.
Yeah, I find that to be interesting that we've got gas prices of, I'm paying right now at Costco, I'm paying $5, over $5 a gallon for premium gas, because I have to put premium gas into my car. And I find it fascinating that we have gone from being energy self-sufficient to paying an exorbitant price, a price almost as high as the Canadians are paying for gas. And that's truly, truly because of the direction of the President of the United States, who I maintain did, the election was stolen from us. And I have to agree with Jerry when you say that. CFS also, you say that. So I think we have to quit saying we lost the election. We did lose the election, just like a bank loses money when there's an effective robbery. We were robbed. Jimmy, wrap it up. We got about a minute and a half.
Yeah, so I'm very worried about the regulations that have been put in place in order to force people, the federal government, the Biden administration, using regulatory edicts from the White House to restrict oil development, gas development, pipelines, and that are increasing our need to import oil while simultaneously, in, you know, skyrocketing prices and forcing prices so high, with a stated agenda by the Energy Secretary, by the Vice President, by the President himself, that, hey, look, force people into electric cars, force people into a different mode of transportation to get away from carbon fuels.
Right.
That is an impossible task. It will not solve the problem. But the policies are trying to intimidate and force Americans to change, not just Americans, but the world, to change policies based on a notion that somehow we're destroying our economy destroying the world with carbon. And I think that's a very dangerous precedent to set, and it's causing a lot of economic damage.
Very dangerous. Stick around, you guys. Big Al and Jimmy are going to be right back. We're going to take the whole next hour of the show, and we're going to talk about topics of major concern to us. Stick around.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in here to wrap up the first half of KER Politics. We've been talking in a number of the daily editorials this week, which you radio listeners don't unfortunately get a chance to hear. I'll tell you how you can do that at some point in time. But voter fraud is something that I am getting very, very involved with. Frieda did an excellent daily editorial earlier in the week, and I asked her if she'd repeat that, because voter fraud is something that is going to hit us right between the eyes in the upcoming November election of this year. Frieda, what do you have to say?
Well, thank you so much, Al, for contributing and working on this. We really could use that, and you're going to make a huge difference, so I appreciate that. And that's why I went on into this topic as well, because we need to keep re-identifying what is voter fraud. And then again, the next part of my editorial is going to be how to stop it. So, you know, voter fraud has been documented throughout this nation's history by historians and journalists. In one New York election in 1844, 55,000 votes were recorded, even though there were only 41,000 eligible voters. So let's look at this picture a little bit. How is it that this keeps going on in history, and even more so recently? There are different types of election frauds. Number one is the impersonation fraud at the polls. They actually go in, they vote in the name of other legitimate voters. And votes and voters who have died, moved away, or lost their right to vote because they are felons, but remain registered, well, they're fraudulent, and they go ahead and they use these people to vote. They use their names. And then there's false registration, using false names or addresses. And we have more going on here with duplicate voting, which is registering in multiple locations. So there's so many kinds of fraudulent votes. And just to continue, this is something that is voters are getting paid to either cast a vote for another person that they're really not interested in doing, absentee ballot for a candidate. They're paying these voters to cast some either an in-person or absentee ballot for a candidate. And then there's the fraudulent use of absentee ballots, forging a signature or illegally telling the voters who to vote for. Illegal voting, illegal registration, and voting by individuals who are not U.S. citizens, are convicted felons, or not eligible to vote. Illegal assistance at the polls, forcing or intimidating voters, particularly the elderly, disabled, the illiterate, or those for whom English is a second language, to vote for certain candidates while supposedly providing them with assistance, altering the vote count, changing the vote count either in a precinct or at the central location where votes are counted. Each state is generally responsible for the administration of its own electoral systems. The state government must take the responsibility seriously and adopt policies sufficient to secure their elections against fraud, including efforts by non-citizens to vote and by citizens registered in multiple states. So just imagine how much of this fraud is going on that we have not been looked at, and specifically the ones that I mentioned. If we could adhere to this and really adopt a way of knowing what to look for, would really change the way we vote. And I'm going to continue, Al, unless you want to say something, how to stop.
No, I want you to continue. You're doing good. This is almost like a civics lecture, and I appreciate it. Go for it.
Well, thank you, Al. You know, because we need to know. I didn't know this till I researched it either, of all the different kinds of voter frauds to look for. And then we have to look at how to stop this. And the Heritage Foundation has outlined several policies states should adopt. A required government issued identification, the proof of citizenship. So we should all have this type of identification. States should enter into interstate voter registration, cross-check progress to identify voters and the programs registered in multiple states. So we need to do that as well. And they should verify the accuracy of their voters' registrations by comparing with jury forms and other government records to identify non-citizens so they can be removed from the voter rolls. The federal government should cooperate with state efforts to clean up their registrations and make Department of Homeland Security and other data available to state officials for this purpose alone. There are now 34 states that have laws requiring voters to show some form of identification at the polls, and a small number of states have extended that ID requirement to absentee ballots should that be implemented. So, for example, in New Jersey, in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, most ballots have been sent to active registered voters, and the return envelopes are barcoded so ballots can be traced. Voters' signatures will be checked against the registration rolls, and anyone mailed a ballot who attempts to vote in person will be given a provisional ballot that will be verified and counted after all the mail ballots have been processed. So in 2020, over 70 million Americans have requested mail ballots, which means that about half of all mail ballots have been mailed. Look at what we need to do, which is something that if we can structure this, the opportunity to have mail fraud will decrease, and the votes that will be coming in will be legitimate, and we'll be able to elect a president in a legitimate manner, because right now everything's up in the air. We don't have the structure, we don't have the know-how, we don't have the background of the people and the ID checks that we need. And we should really have picture ID checks as well, because that really targets who that person is in front of you. We've been too careless, we've looked away too much, and this country, America, is noted to have freedom to be able to vote in a way that's democratic. And we've taken that democracy away from our voting polls.
Well, I got to tell you, we got to watch. We got to keep in mind what Dr. Frieda is saying. I would appreciate, I want to ask listeners a favor to me. Do what I'm going to do. Volunteer in the polls to be an observer. I think that'll at least help a little bit. Thanks, Frieda.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Hope you guys enjoyed the top of the hour news. As I say every week, I hope it was better in your neck of the woods than it was in mine and it was in Jimmy's. Having said that, I'm going to talk about the ineffectiveness of gun control right now. You know, the Texas Massacre, as it's becoming to be known, was a really, really good example of how gun control through unavailability is not the correct way to handle the problem that is raising its ugly head daily in America. Jimmy, your comments.
Yeah, so we've got this, you know, this terrible dilemma, this absolutely horrific event that happened in Uvalde, Texas, where, you know, a crazy 18-year-old spends between $6,000 and $9,000 on weapons, ammunition, a vest, when he has no money. It's very weird, you know, part-time worker, I think, at a Burger King or something like that. he gets involved in basically attacks a school after publicly stating on social media and actually being called on social media that a school shooter and bragging about it and attempting to, you know, contact people to explain what he was going to do. He goes, drives into a school. He shoots up. The cops respond absolutely miserably. A very strange set of circumstances and events that should have been stopped very soon. But of course, after an hour and I believe hour and 17 minutes, they finally were killed.
I think it was closer to 22 minutes, but it still was way too long.
Wait, well, it's an hour and 17 or hour and 22 minutes from the time that he entered the school until he was killed by Border Patrol agents and their special tactics team. Right. When the law enforcement, the local law enforcement, failed to do, basically halted the attempts to try to save children. And apparently a number of children died after the fact. Regardless, the tragedy of that is really not a justification to take away people's constitutional Second Amendment rights that say this shall not be, the right to bear arms shall not be abridged. You can't do that. You can't change that without really taking control of the nation and changing the Constitution.
Right.
And apparently, Democrats think that their emotional appeal is strong enough for them to make statements like the Democratic Congressman Sicilian from Rhode Island said yesterday that spare me the BS, quote, I'm paraphrasing here, the BS about constitutional rights during a Dundee debate. You know, they're willing to sacrifice constitutional rights in order to punish law-abiding citizens when in fact the problem is very clearly not with the individuals that are following the law. You
right.
can't pass more laws to stop something like this, and you're certainly not going to confiscate 300 to 400 million guns in America, nor change the Constitution. So basically what they're doing is using this tragedy, the Democrats are using this tragedy as a political tool to fire up the emotions, very similar to they used the COVID fear tactics.
Yeah.
To appeal to a voter base that will basically turn out and help them. I think it's a huge mistake on their part, and I think they just do not understand that their policies, the policies that Democratic leaders in major Democratic cities attempting to put gun control have failed miserably. You look at the statistics in Detroit, in apparently it's doing a little bit better right now because they got a pretty strong share police chief down there, but in Baltimore, in Chicago, in New York, basically people are dying in the most restrictive gun control areas in the country that are run by Democrats. Their policies fail. They are trying to cut law enforcement budgets. They are destroying safety and security in America. And unfortunately, they are willing to continue to push against basic constitutional rights that allow people to defend themselves, when in fact the only time that a cop comes is after the act happened. So if someone breaks into your house, he's not coming to save you then. He's coming after somebody is shot and killed.
Right.
So you better be able to defend yourself, in my view, especially as they try to cut the funding and make it harder for cops to help you.
Well, I mean, it's become pretty obvious in our country that a lot of people would not have been killed, for example, in Texas if they had a defense mechanism set up. A lot of people wouldn't have been killed at Sandy Hook. A lot of kids would not have been killed at Sandy Hook if a defense mechanism was being set up. But instead of concentrating on a defense mechanism, what the powers that be are concentrating on is a simple legislation. So the guns are difficult, if not impossible to get, you know?
Well, and it's like, you know, dangerous people, criminals, people that are going to go out and hurt people should not have guns.
Right.
I don't question that ever. I'm not going to, you know, that's not the argument here. The question is, what type of policies do you put in place that protect individuals from such craziness? And how much do you use? And again, we have to be very careful of our personal liberties across the board, because if you, in fact, establish some of these policies you're going to be able to take away the rights of many individuals based on assumptions.
Right.
Based on almost like there's a movie out, a Minority Report, a Tom Cruise movie, pre-crime, where you where law enforcement thinks that you might cause a problem. And, you know, we can't allow that. Ultimately, it is a challenging society to live in. So how do we work on making each other trust each other better? And how do we educate and inform and give people self-confidence and not get this hate and not encourage the drug use, not encourage these crazy ideologies that undermine faith and confidence in each other and in our society, in our faith, in our moral values? And that's where I see our biggest problem is today. The left is undermining church. They're undermining trust. They're undermining faith in God. They're undermining basic principles that have humanity has evolved over many, many years with in order to improve our society. And they're taking those away in order to achieve political power and put us under the thumb of a state, which is exactly what, you know, powerful authoritarians have done throughout history.
It's not going to work, and it's it hasn't worked. It's not going to work. You know, they're giving credence to the people are trying to give credence to the statement that a democracy can only last for about 200 years, and then it won't work anymore. Well, we're getting pretty close to 200 years, but I have to tell you, I think that the American democracy, personally, if we can just get out of this abyss that we're in right now, and it is an abyss, if we can just get out of this, I think we're going to be in pretty good shape. And I think we're going to show the world that freedom and democracy is going to win in the end. There is no way that the current administration is able to do that, because they are absolutely too set in their ways. Hell, they can't even keep their kids straight in their own family. Sad situation, Jimmy. Very, very sad situation. Why don't you wrap it up? We got about a minute.
Yeah, so, you know, as I'm you think this through and you realize how many problems we're facing in America, and then you look back and say, okay, how well were we doing prior to COVID? You know, we had we'd actually had a long string of reduced crime and kind of positive belief in each other.
Right.
You had this little blip during the Obama administration, which I believe created a tremendous problem with the racial equity type of issues and the diversity. And somehow those people have now taken control. The crazies, the left, the climate ideologists, the BLM people, the Antifa, they've taken control of the left. They're driving us into the ground, and people are not willing to stand up because they're afraid. And of course, that's how they use the power and the influence in order to achieve their political ends.
Yeah. Keep it going, Jimmy. You got 10 seconds.
Yeah, no, so I think we may have a hope here. Can get a good election.
We're going to have a good election. We're going to make sure up here, at least in the Northwest, that we do. I got about 32 people signed up to be witnesses to election. We're going to try to prevent tampering. You know, it's really interesting walking into my studio today. I was looking at my library, and the first book that popped out of my mind was Fyodor Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. It's really interesting. That's a great, great way to assess what's going on in our country today. I have to say, we're going to talk a little bit about Bill Barr. We're going to talk a little bit about Sussman. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the fact that Perkins Coie actually has a secure area in their office now to house the FBI. That kind of stinks, in my opinion. Jimmy, take it any place you want.
Yeah, so there's been, you know, obviously a lot that went on this week that people need to pay attention to if they at all want to protect the Constitution of the United States. And that is primarily...
See, there's a novel idea.
Yeah, you know, that's what I have my life on the line for the last, you know, 30, 40 years, watching it, you know, collapse so quickly with literally the Department of Justice and the FBI being used as political pawns, and in some cases, active participants to support political offices in this country. You know, Richard Nixon resigned from office and was threatened in impeachment. Thankfully, he resigned rather than put the country through the pain because they were getting involved. He had some people on his staff that got marginally involved in spying on the Democratic Party through the Watergate Hotel back in the day, mm-hmm. through the 72 election, and got caught at it. And they, you know, everybody took it pretty seriously. But here we have the Department of Justice, the FBI, cooperating directly with the legal team of the Democratic Party and the legal and lawyers for the Hillary Clinton campaign, mm-hmm. in order to spread misinformation, in order to shift the outcome of an election. That's the Justice Department and the FBI and members, Jim Comey, Peter Strzok, Andrew McCabe, Lisa Page, as well as, you know, Kevin Kleinsmith, one of the lawyers that actually fabricated, changed information to blame a source of the FBI and the CIA on being a Russian pawn in order to attack the Trump campaign, the presidential campaign of 2016, and then continue through his election. This is unprecedented in U.S. history. And unfortunately, the example of a rogue Department of Justice. Without Department of Justice, you have no faith in law enforcement or the Constitution of the United States for at least half the population. And hopefully those that actually believe in the Constitution will begin to realize that it could be used against them if the wrong power comes in on the other side.
Right.
And what we saw this last week with the Durham trial of Michael Sussman, the lawyer for Perkins Coie, is that he was given a not guilty verdict from a DC jury after clear evidence that he had lied to the FBI in order to manipulate them. And the FBI themselves were involved and jumped on this knowing that the information was false. Unfortunately, Durham did not take that seriously. He did not go after the FBI agents. Hopefully he will, but it looks like we have such a corrupt system that the Washington people inside the D.C. Beltway or the Justice Department protect their own. I think something has to change. The evidence is overwhelming, and the media just sits back. And really, if you go back and compare the difference between what was rather, in comparison, a very minor issue with the Watergate issue, which yeah. forced a presidential resignation, you see an unbelievable abuse of power right now in Washington, mm-hmm. and nothing's being done about it.
You know, if you tell a progressive right now what you just said about a rather minor event, i.e. bugging the apartment at Watergate, compared to what's going on right now, they'll call you a communist. They will call you worse than a communist. But, you know, it's very, very true. The difference is staggering, in my opinion. The way the opposition party, to us anyway, appears is that they are basically running roughshod over Americans. And I know I've been going over comments this morning from our blog. Very, very interesting blog. Boy, I think you almost need to have an IQ test in order to be included on the blog. Some of those comments are so insightful and so, so good. For lack of better terms, why I'm using that too much when I'm not really sure what today. I just want to give a compliment to the bloggers. You know, our country right now, Jim, the direction that we are headed in terms of the unlawful activities of the people in power is staggering to me. I'd like you to elaborate just a little bit on that.
Yeah, let's go back to what you said when you opened that little piece right there. You know, the comparison with Watergate, you know, there were political operatives inside the Nixon campaign that mm-hmm. actually took action on their own to try to bug or get information on the Democratic Party and the Watergate offices.
Right.
Well, okay, those are political operatives. What we have today is the U.S. intelligence community, including the National Security Agency, with unbelievable access to individual information, to telephone conversations, to email conversations, to text conversations, reaching into a political campaign. The NSA and the DOJ given authority to the FBI to investigate people based on false information. This isn't political operatives from the Clinton campaign or the DNC taking action. These are actual massively powerful government institutions that are doing the bidding for a political party in order to basically destroy their political opposition. And there's something just, Orwellian about having the FBI and the DOJ. Information is clearly out there showing that they knew that the information on the Trump campaign that they were coordinating with Russia through the Alpha Bank network, that they were somehow cooperating and getting information from the Russians in order to smear Hillary Clinton. They knew it was false information. They knew early on, and they continued to investigate to the point where they put a special prosecutor, put the entire nation through an unbelievably painful undermining of confidence in the Trump administration, had numerous people fired, had people put in jail for lying about things that were completely irrelevant, and sometimes just, like Roger Stone, just forgetting about an email or some, very obscure point. But they win in those cases. And now we have a guy like Michael Sussman, who clearly, operated for the Clinton campaign, seated the FBI, James Baker, the senior legal representative for the FBI, seeded information with him and then passed it to press sources in order to leak it. And nobody does anything about it, and everybody thinks it's okay. I don't know how we can continue as a nation if we have this type of destructive policies going on in the political arena using the tools of the NSA, using the Department of Justice, using the FBI, using contractors under contract. And then, as you said from the beginning, Michael Sussman, the guy that seeded this information, apparently, according to reporting from the Congress, from congressional representatives, had a workstation for the FBI in the Perkins Coie office in Washington, D.C. to connect directly with the FBI. And as they were under contract with the DNC and the Clinton campaign, how much more corrupt can it be?
About the only comment I can make is I had some interesting discussions yesterday in our men's breakfast club up here at the clubhouse, and it was very, very interesting in the sense we've got, 40 or 50 or 60 guys in there. Yeah, we got some Democrats. Yeah, we got some Republicans. But the fervor right now of the Republicans, some of which are running for office right now locally, but many of which are just like me, just like you, in the sense that we want to do everything that we can, Jimmy, to try and get the House and the Senate back, try to get Congress back. And I think that we're going to be able to do that. But some of the comments just parrot almost exactly what you're saying, Jim. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, and so, I really hope that we as a nation can get that percentage. You're never going to get the extremists, that 20 to 30% that actually do not listen and don't have common sense. And that's on both sides of the aisle. But the people in the middle are starting to wake up. The economy, the security, their safety, the border, the potential devastating issues around the world right now have to be waking people up, and I certainly hope that's happening.
KER Politics has been a ball this week, and I hope you guys enjoyed it.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.